Hi everyone, this is Tim at North and South Podcasts. Hope you are well for the new year, and today it's a real honour to speak to who is someone I first heard about from Chris Lewis, who I've done a podcast with before, through the Big Onion at Bootle Strand, and that is part of Merseyside Expanding Horizons, which is about investing in underprivileged areas and helping people to get started in new initiatives, etc. And he mentioned Paul by name and said to check out Paul's excellent organisation, Pact Mentality. And I've actually been doing a bit of work with Paul's organisation behind the scenes, which I'm looking forward to telling you about in the near future. So, Paul, I've had some good conversations with Paul, but I wanted to have a proper standalone podcast just to share good news and also about how you can change your life and how you can get involved with Pact Mentality and look to improve things, particularly as we welcome 2024. It's a beautiful day today out there, Paul. What's it like around your way? How are you?
Lovely, mate. Yeah, it's lovely. I'm based in Litherland, mate. So,
oh, you in Litherland?
Nice in Litherland, mate. Yeah, it's nice and cold.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm just down the road from you, but I went to the beach this morning. My lad was doing rugby. It was absolutely beautiful down there, so it's all good. So how are you, then? Do you want to just introduce yourself and tell us very briefly what Pact Mentality is about?
Yeah, so Pact Mentality, it's a human performance, human development institute that focuses very much on mental wellness, on helping people to reach their full potential in life. I look after the men's side of the organisation, and my partner Carly looks after the women's side of it, and together we deliver our courses. So we do a level 1, 2, and 3 programme, and we do individualised programmes, and we also, sometimes we come together with certain programmes. Now, the type of work that we deliver is very much, a holistic range of services, if you like, to, empower people in terms of their own mental well-being, the physical well-being, their emotional well-being, and also the spiritual well-being. And when we talk about spiritual well-being, it's more about them being connected to their purpose in life, to what it is they actually want to go on to achieve, because we see so many people that are stuck in jobs that they don't like, stuck in careers they don't like. They may have unresolved emotional issues from childhood. Certainly in Liverpool, if you like, there's a massive issue, if you like, with mental health, and certainly in men, if you like, this, the city that we live in is very much we've been raised, if you like, Tim, to be tough. So it's very much like, you get up and, it's a man up mentality, if you like, that we just crack on, that you don't show emotion, that we don't cry, that we just, sort of stiffen our upper lip and just crack on with life. Now, through obviously my own journey, if you like, I've learned that that type of mentality and that type of maybe cultural conditioning didn't work for me. So that's obviously why I am sitting where I am right now, is to obviously deliver everything that I've invested in and what's worked for me, firstly to the people of this city and then further afield.
That's brilliant. And there's so much there that I kind of connect with. And I think this is a global issue and this is a human issue, but there is a certain thing about Liverpool, I think, and in many ways, I'm not saying that it doesn't happen in other places, but I think like northern towns, northern cities in the UK tend to be quite underprivileged, and people can come to Liverpool and go around the city centre and go, oh, this is amazing, etc. And there's some lovely suburbs in Liverpool, and, I love the people of Liverpool, but there is a certain way of being a man in Liverpool, quite traditional, where you don't talk about emotions, you get on with it, you don't really question things. And the idea of like holistic development, spiritual development, people shy away from that word, don't be spiritual. But as you say, it's about like, what's your purpose? What are you here for? And I was reading a good book the other day, The Daily Stoic by Ryan Holiday. And in it, he said, like, when you say to people, like, who are you? What are you doing? What are you here for? These are questions like people just don't think about that often. And that's where you connect with why you're here. And to take this work to other people, I think that's a real privilege. And it's fantastic, the work that you're doing. Now, you're based in southern Liverpool, even though you live in the north end. You're based in the southern end of Liverpool for your organisation?
Yeah, we do a lot of our work out of, well, there's two places that we use. We use the Inagudo, which is based on Walton Road.
Yep.
And they've also got a hub and men's hub on Rice Lane. So they're two centres that we use. But then we also use Bellisio, which you don't want to do as well, for some of our sessions. So we're mainly, you know, we're delivering there. But, you know, we also work out of some schools sometimes. We'll go into schools to take this work to the younger men and the younger women, if you like, of the city before they maybe get to adulthood, to give them. We feel, obviously, the earlier you can catch people, the better. You know, we've discussed the work that we do at the I Am Project, which is doing amazing work, very aligned with what we do at PACT in terms of being able to, rather than seek the effects, we're trying to get to the cause before it happens, if you like.
That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it's good that you're based around the city as well in different places. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the work that you're doing in schools. What's your kind of background in relation to this journey? Because for me, I've shared with listeners before, like I was 29, and the idea of self-help, personal development, spiritual development, acknowledging mental health issues, etc. I was a completely different person. When I was 29, I had a bit of a, I wouldn't call it a breakdown, but I had like a problem with medication I was taking that triggered if you like, poor mental health for a few years. And it just got me to completely reevaluate things. And I feel like I've been making breakthroughs ever since. Mm. And looking back at that person I was before 29, I just feel like that person just didn't know things. And maybe the future me will look back at me now and say a similar thing. But what's been your kind of journey to appreciation this more, appreciating more holistic development?
Yeah, I think certainly going through my own childhood, seeing my own dad struggle. My own dad suffered, he was an alcoholic, and then he basically ended up being medicated by the doctors for bipolar disorder, for depression. He had, you know, he had a breakdown, and all they did was medicate him. So they give him lithium, they give him all these really strong antipsychotic medications. So, yeah, it did stop him maybe drinking alcohol, and he did come off and stop that type of behaviour. But we lost our dad in the way that it completely molded who he was. He lost his personality to an extent. The way he was walking, the way his mouth was moving, like all his this medication they were giving him to sedate who he was, rather than ever dealing with the cause. They were just treating the effects. My dad was suffering mentally because of effects that had happened in his life. And not once did the doctors say, what happened in your childhood? Which to me, Tim, is absolutely disgraceful. That doesn't take place. And it's still common practice, by the way, in GP surgeries. We go to see a consultant or a therapist in the hospital or a specialist. They never say, how stressful is your life? What's going on in your childhood? Why have you got an illness? They're not making the mind-body connection. We're sort of setting people up to fail because we're treating the effects. So I seen that firsthand happening with my dad. And then in my life, personally, when I was about the age of 10, say, I started to realise that I probably felt a little bit disconnected and lonely myself as a young boy, which then led into being quite angry and aggressive when I was maybe stepping into my teenage years. And then I discovered boxing, which really helped at the time. But around the age of 15, even though I was still struggling, I decided one time to just go home. Put my dad's tablets on the table because I felt so disconnected. They had no one to talk to. Put his lithium tablets on the table, and I took about 20 to 30 tablets and just took them. Now I woke up the next day and I was just wired. If you like, and my mum and dad were asking, what's wrong? What have you took? And I said, nothing, I'm okay. Now that took me to the age of 32, I'd say 31 maybe, to speak that I actually even did that. So for me, that was never a cry for help. I wasn't looking for anybody to save me. I was looking for a way out of some sort of the pain that I was carrying that was unprocessed and unresolved with me because it felt like there was nobody there. Now, after that attempt, if you like, to take my own life, I then met my partner, Carly, and I continued my boxing, and we ended up having a child really young. But then I started maybe getting involved in the wrong circles, if you like, and taking drugs. So we first started when I was about, I'd say about 17, 18, started taking ecstasy. So I was having ecstasy every weekend, if you like, going to the pleasure rooms in town. After being someone who was so disciplined with boxing, to go from one extreme to the other, I was a completely different person then. in terms of I was just hitting maybe the self-destruct button. So I was going out every weekend, taking drugs. Ended up having our lad now, who's 17. We had him when I think we were 19. And from that point, I think I spent a year in. I got myself a job. I was an engineer, done an apprenticeship. Probably spent a year trying to be the father he deserved. And then I discovered what anabolic steroids were then at about the age of 20. And that was probably the worst thing I ever did. Because I was then taking anabolic steroids, I then started taking cocaine. My hormones were absolutely all over the place. I had a lot of unprocessed trauma and emotions that were stored within me. I was going out acting like, you know, probably what I thought was a normal lad in this city, maybe acting in unhealthy and toxic ways, womanizing, thinking I was Jack the Lad, but deep down knew that that was never really me showing up. From that point, and again, seeking this attention, if you like, and seeking to be seen, I ended up working on the doors in town. So I got myself on the doors in town while I was also an engineer. So I was doing two jobs at the time while I was partying every weekend, while I was having these anger outbursts and these emotional rages, if you like. And that again was probably one of the worst things I've ever done. But I look back at it now, it was something that needed to happen because I was just really involved in the wrong type of lifestyle, considering the heart of God and the person that I am, which led me to about the age of 24, where I ended up in, it was sort of, I always call it, was maybe the darkest point of my life, and where I was, a point that I was on my knees, if you like. And I ended up in court. I was on two counts of assault. I'd just lost my job as an engineer. We had our second child on the way, who's now my little boy, Thomas. He's 11. And I was addicted to cocaine and anabolic steroids. And I was just absolutely broken. Like, I used to cry all the time. I was taking cocaine all the time. I didn't want to be alive. So this then got me to a point where when I had my second child on the way, I believe that that was maybe the saving grace for me. Because when I went to court and I didn't go to jail, he basically said to me, if you don't plead guilty, then you're going to jail for at least a year. So obviously I had to change my plea at that point. And that was the catalyst, if you like. I think in the January, I went to the Army, the Army Careers Office. I was thinking, what's the hardest thing that I can possibly do to really break this chain of whatever's going on for me? And fitness and boxing was always something I wanted to do and that I enjoyed. So for me, growing up, and my boxing coach also being involved with this regiment, the toughest regiment in the Army to be in, bar the SAS, was the Paras. So I decided, you know, I went in the careers office, I was 15 stone, something full of still juice water, if you like, and muscle that I was carrying. And he said to me, your BMI is far too high, you need to run a mile and a half in 9 minutes 30, you need to lose this much weight. And I said, okay. So that was in 2012. Now, by the end, I'd say, of 2012, I was signed up then for the reserve regiment of the Paras. I had my weight down to 13 and a half stone. I was running a mile and a half in 9 minutes 30, say. And I ended up going in the parachute regiment then and got my job back as an engineer. So I went in the reserve regiment in the Paras, and I was also an engineer at the time. And I think there were 17 lads out of 80 that ended up passing the training. So that was in 2013 to get like the Maroon Beret, which for me was a very proud moment. It was something that signified change and maybe a step into manhood, and was an initiation period for me, if you like, to be able to go through that to prove to myself that I had mentally, I had everything it took to be what I thought. This is what a man is. He's someone who's tough, physically fit, mentally strong. Now, after I passed out in the June 2013, I then, probably after a day or two, started to feel empty again. I felt this emptiness happening inside, and I was like, okay, now I've passed, now I'm a man, now what? And then spent, obviously, about 18 months, I'd say, to 2 years in the reserve regiment, and it wasn't really giving me what I needed. I found that this emptiness kept coming up in me, that I felt like I was nothing, that I kept having to try and prove myself. So I thought, it must be money, because I'm earning okay money as an engineer, but not that great. I've now got a second child. I want my own house. I want to have cars. I want to go on holidays every year. That will make me happy. So I got myself a job offshore in Saudi Arabia, which was, you know, extremely difficult to even get offshore. But I absolutely pestered people on LinkedIn. I was just messaging, maybe sending 100 messages a night. And eventually I stumbled across a guy who said, yeah, I'm looking for an engineer to come over with me. So I went over offshore in Saudi, Tim, and then when I was on the helicopter, started having a panic attack. I couldn't breathe. I was thinking I was going to die. When I was leaving my kids from home, I was breaking down in tears. Something was happening. But I wanted the money. And I thought, well, when I've got all the money, when I've got the houses, when I've got the cars, when I've got the holidays, then I've got everything that I should need externally that should tick every single box to say I'll be happy. So I worked offshore for a couple of years. I got myself a house. I was having cars out the holidays. I had two beautiful kids doing really well in their life. I had a beautiful partner. Was I happy? No. So I thought it must be maybe because I'm away from home, maybe because I'm not spending time with my kids, I'm getting general anxiety disorder or attachment disorder. So I got myself a really well-paid job again back home. I mean, I was earning between, this must have been 2015, I was earning between 18 to 20 pounds an hour at home, doing 60-hour weeks. So I thought, it's a grand a week. You know, maybe I'm staying away 5 days, 4 days a week, but I'm with my kids every weekend. Done that again for maybe a year or two. Was I happy? No, still having these panic attacks, still having problems. Did not know what was going on. I was training all the time. I was fit. You know, people come to me and say, if you want to be mentally well, go to the gym. Didn't work for me. I was going to the gym all the time. There wasn't a fitter person that I probably knew with a better mentality, you know, in terms of I'd never give up. But still, I was having these panic attacks and these problems. So I got myself a job as a project manager in Liverpool, and I was at home most of the time. I was able to, it was flexible. I could take my kids to what they needed to go to. I was earning really good money, 40 to 45 grand a year. Should be happy, right? Should have been. No. These problems are still happening, this anxiety, this fear within me. So I decided to go to the doctors. And the doctor, basically, as soon as I went in, they prescribed me to go and get CBT. And they've also given me some SSRI medication. I think it was citalopram at the time. Took the citalopram. Did it help? Yeah. It basically nulled my feelings and my felt sense. So was I feeling depression or anxiety anymore? No. Was I feeling joyful though? No. I wasn't feeling joyful at all. So I changed the medication. They put me on something called sertraline. I went on the sertraline maybe for a couple of months to a year. Again, very similar. I was having all these different problems with them. Something they don't tell you is that SSRI medication can lower testosterone levels. How do I know that? I have taken testosterone because I was on anabolic steroids, so I had low testosterone anyway, which affects how you feel as a man. So I get my testosterone checked. So when I was taking the SSRIs, I noticed that my testosterone was depleting and getting lower. Although I wasn't maybe as joyful and happy as I should be, I was actually flat as a man, and that was felt like it was making me more flat. So I went to the doctors, I would say, in about 2017, 2018, and basically made the decision at that point that I was coming off medication. And because I had money in the bank, I decided I am now going to start investing and doing this myself. Because I was trying to go the route of the NHS, and it just, the services that were available, the help that was there was shocking. There's actually no help. There's barely any support. You're treating effects. You're not treating cause. They're not giving you any on-the-spot practices to help alleviate symptoms that are showing up. So I started to invest in working with people around the world. If you like, I was working with hypnotherapists. I was working with trauma specialists, neuroscientists. I was going to men's retreats, working with spiritual teachers, men's coaches, meditation teachers, breath scientists, respiratory scientists, sleep doctors, working with all these different people, people looking into different elements of psychology, of how we show up the way we do, looking at the nervous system, looking at basically how the whole human experience is designed and how we play our part within that and what control we actually have. So from investing, you know, a hell of a lot of money in my own personal development, I decided from that point, after being on a men's retreat, I had a conversation with a men's coach who was actually on the retreat, and I designed basically a property company that was called Pact. And I said to him that I'm gonna basically, my goal is to make all this money and to, you know, be financially free and give my kids whatever, you know, whatever I didn't have. And he said to me, you know, we went on this big walk and we were on this mountain and this hill, and we were walking down together. And he basically said to me, what would that mean to you though? What would that mean to your kids? If they had all that, do you not think they'd rather have their dad doing something he wanted to do, being happy? And I basically told him the story I've just told you. And he said to me, do you not think that story could change so many people's lives and that you're not good enough to go and deliver that type of work to people? Because I believe you are, in how you speak and how authentic you are and how you've just delivered what you've just told me. You could absolutely go and do that. So that sort of planted the seed. I left that retreat in the September. By the January, I was delivering. So Pac's nearly 4 years old, if you like. By the January, I started, the course was writ. So everything was just coming through to me. I was doing a lot of meditations, doing a lot of inner work. I'm just getting all this information coming through, all these ideas. That's, for me, how I knew that I was doing what I was meant to be doing, because of the excitement and the speed that everything was just happening at. So by the January, I put my first course out there, filled up with 10 men, delivered it, and I just absolutely loved it. And I just knew this is what I was meant to be doing, but I was still doing the project managing, if you like. So from that point, I built Pact to a place that it was financially sustainable, and I could no longer continue my project managing job that, you know, yet I enjoyed, but it wasn't fulfilling me. When I become too stretched, I decided I've got enough savings in the bank. I'm making money right now, but I'm just going to have to take the leap of faith, because if I don't, I'm always going to be doing what I've always done. And if you always do that, you're always going to get the same results. So I had to take the step, and I did. I jumped. And basically, I'm here today now. Yet I've had a lot of problems. A lot of mistakes have been made by myself, by Carly. You know, I'm not a businessman, if you like. I'm someone just doing what he loves, trying to save other people, where maybe finances isn't at the top of my goals list or values, but I'm learning maybe to bring that more into it in certain dimensions, because I realise for me to give back and to me to be of service in the way that I want to be, I need to be earning money, and I need to be able to have money to invest back into myself to get to the people I want to get to.
That's such a powerful story, not just about self-discovery, but about listening to yourself, heeding advice from others and saying, what do you really want? And I think it's the secret, you know, that thing, the secret everyone goes on about, which isn't everyone's cup of tea, but there's a bit in that in the film where there's a guy talking to the woman, and he goes, like, just say to yourself every now and again, like, what do you want? Are you doing what you want to do? And I think it's very important that we take a step back and do that regularly, because it's so easy to just miss things, and they often say things are hidden in plain sight. And I just relate so much to what you said, and there's so much stuff that we could look at in more detail to do with what you just said. But you've obviously been through a lot of what might be called like capital T trauma and small T trauma. And for me as a male, processing things in life, I always found that hard when I was younger, until I learned there's things you can do to help you to manage that, and there's things that you can do to make yourself a better person. So it sounds like you've gone through this complete journey of self-discovery, and then now, by helping others, you're finding your true meaning by seeking to help others and take that out into the world. So Pact, we're going to share the website, but Pact Mentality, it's not just for men, is it? Carly does the women's side of it, and it's all about holistic stuff. You offer lots of courses, don't you?
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us a little bit more about some of the services that you provide?
Yeah, so what I would say to Pact is, basically, there's nothing like there out there in the world, in my opinion, because the services don't provide it. So my angle is I come at it from lived experience. I come at it as the average working man who is now performing at a level that I never thought was possible. I never thought I could be free of anxiety, of depression, of trauma, of pains. There's stuff still come up for me, absolutely, but I have the tools and the capability and the capacity to move through it with grace and not to allow myself to attach to an outcome in what's happening in my relationship, in what's happening in my life, in my financial situation. There's a lot more trust within me that I trust myself and how I move forward, if that makes sense to him. And that's come through, you know, you mentioned trauma, and it's come through processing a lot of my own stuff, if you like, because my parents, although they tried the best, I loved them. Was I failed in some capacity? Absolutely. Are we all in some capacity not meeting our children in ways they need to be met? Absolutely, because that comes through how we've been conditioned maybe in the West, that if my child comes to me and says that he's angry, usually the first thing we say to our child when they're angry, go to your room. Go to your room and calm down. That's sending the message to our child that you're not lovable when you're angry, which means we're conditioning him to show up and not be authentic. That anger's not going outwards, it's going inwards. That anger goes inwards, it comes out in mental health problems, it comes out in disease, because the body's constantly trying to find equilibrium and homeostasis. It can't find that if we're constantly being told to not be ourselves. So me finding my true authenticity, if you like, as a man, so I could be authentic to myself. If I'm angry, I will maybe express it in a way that's not dangerous to other people, that it doesn't come out in violence or rage, because that scares my children, that scares my partner, and that's not okay. But actually teaching people and teaching our children how to express healthy anger and how to self-regulate their own emotional imbalances, if you like, when they show up, that's healthy. Hugging our kids when they're angry is healthy. Loving them when maybe they're not doing the things we want them to do is healthy. You know, at the end of the day, we are meant to be connected as human beings. We've probably never had our internal life, if you like, in terms of our homes and the way we live, so comfortable. Yet we've never been so sick.
Yeah.
So that, and we've never been so connected via technology, but we've never been so disconnected from one another at the same time. So for me, you know, learning to form authentic human connection is probably at the foundations of wellness for me. Sorry, I feel like I've just gone off on one.
No. I read a book actually called The Book You Wish Your Parents Had Read by Philippa Perry last year. And I wrote down, I've got a 4-year-old son, and there was a lot in there. I don't know if you've heard of Paul Cope, who's based in Liverpool, about his multiple personality analysis of people, etc., and how we work. And there's so much I hear from, particularly people like yourself, men who've gone into like the idea of self-discovery and then sharing that with others, who find that true meaning through doing that. But the first part of that is about realising the way we were brought up and the way we were taught things by people who meant well, by the society that we lived in, etc. That hasn't always helped. And I think that that's a big step, that we acknowledge emotions. I mean, I'm a school teacher, and when I went to school, they didn't talk about mental health. They didn't talk about emotions. I don't think there were people who were like out as being gay or anything like that either. It was all very hush-hush. And it is getting better in schools, but there's still huge issues with the curriculum, this kind of one-dimensional academic curriculum, which got worse about 10 years ago, where you're basically saying to people, could you imagine if someone said to you, I mean, a lot of adults do this with jobs anyway, and this will lead into the schools programme, which we'll discuss in a minute. A lot of adults, like, if you don't like your job, you can say, do you know what, I'm going to get another job, and yet you've got pressure on you to pay the bills, and, you know, what you said about making that transition from doing the project management to doing pack mentality, I want to come back to that a little bit later as well, and how difficult that can be, but adults can say, I don't want to do that. And they say as well, like, who are the people who you spend most of your time with? Are they a good impact on you? Are you in a job that is fulfilling? And yet we say to kids and young people, up until the age of 18, you go to this place and you do this thing, and I don't care how you feel about it. That's what you do. And that's wrong. That is fundamentally wrong. Now, some kids will do well. I did well at school, largely. And, you know, I went on and did A-levels and did degree and became a teacher. And I found a lot of fulfillment in that. But if someone says to me, go on a course, as an adult, I often go on a course and go, God, this is awful, this. Or you're doing something you don't want to do. And as an adult, you're thinking, I don't want to be doing this. And imagine someone saying to you, oh, no, I don't care. Just got to keep doing it and keep doing it. As an adult, you'd say, that's insanity. That's madness. And yeah, we're saying to young people, get in these institutions, and not just young people, by the way, adults. The NHS, as great as the NHS is, free at the point of delivery, I've had some phenomenal assistance through the National Health Service, and don't want to go down the American model or anything like that, but it doesn't listen or cater to individual needs, and it's very much a systematic, bureaucratic thing. All of the health improvements I've made have been through me getting curious and investigating and pursuing things myself and saying, right, what can I find out? What can this do? What can that do? Oh, this is interesting. What about this? What about that? I've got a genetic illness. I take a lot of, like, strong meds. And I've done some unbelievable things. Like, going gluten-free has probably been the biggest positive thing in my health. And I just literally caught that on a podcast by someone with a long-term health condition saying, by the way, if you've not ever tried going gluten-free, do it for 3 months, and if it doesn't work, go back to gluten. I went, do you know, I'm going to give it a crack, and I did that. No one in the NHS told me to do that. I spoke to a dietitian about it and said, listen, I'm thinking of doing this. So I referred myself to the dietitian. They were like, oh no, I've never helped anyone like this before. And yet the difference that's made to my life, you know, it's really, really significant. And that journey of self-discovery that you've been through, that certainly from 29 onwards I've been through, that's the first part of the process. But to then take it into an organisation which goes into the community like yourself, which is something I'm hoping to do with a CIC, a community interest company I'm setting up, which is, I've had a lot of help through yourself and through Pack Mentality, and I'm really grateful for that. And you're a great example to me, and I think everyone out there. But that thing about going out and helping others and saying, right, let's see what we can do to make things better. You know, isn't that what the human project should be about? Instead of just like gross domestic product and this much as... What about quality of life for people in communities where there's genuine connection? And again, that sounds like a bit of a spiel there, but that's what it's all about, isn't it? What do you think about the school system, Paul? And you've been involved as well in terms of helping schools to deliver courses on things like the I Am Project. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that, your general philosophy as well?
So the way I see it is we are part of a big problem, if you like, because there's a big problem in the world. I believe that doesn't just lie with schools. But when we are born, if you like, from the very moment we maybe go into nursery, we're very much conditioned to compete. Now, when we are in competition all the time, that is the beginning of ego. So there's nothing wrong with competition, healthy competition, but it's all about who's the top of the class, who's not top of the class, who's the clever one, who's a good boy, who's a bad boy, who behaves in class and doesn't behave in class. You can sit there like a robot, who can't sit there like a robot. If you can't sit there like a robot, you're a problem child. And in my honest opinion, a child's not made to sit still. He should be moving, he should be climbing, he should be in nature, he should be self-expressive. And I think what is happening with schools is the kids that can't maybe sit down and do as they're told, they're then made to be the bad kids. Coupled in with that is we have parents working more than they ever have before. They're not getting enough time with their children. They're not getting nurtured and looked after and loved, which is then having an effect on the child because there's something called developmental trauma. If we're not getting our needs met, we're not getting picked up and loved in school or whether that's at home, that is going to create some sort of issue within us. We've then got an issue with devices, that kids are glued to devices. And, you know, I'm working with some kids and they're not getting to bed till 12 o'clock at night and they're on the devices. And then they're up at 6, 7 o'clock in the morning and they're expected to go to school and function and hold their attention span. That's not going to happen because ADHD has been directly linked with lack of sleep. Clearly, if you are not sleeping correctly, you're not going to have a good attention span. You're going to maybe be erratic in the terms of, you know, how you show up. That coupled in with a family dynamic, that for me, there's an attack on the family dynamic because men and women there's probably, right now, I've never known so many couples to be breaking up, so many families to be parting, so many young men, because that's where I focus my field of expertise, if you like, are being brought up without a father. That has a detrimental effect, which all ties into a bigger, it's a systematic problem for me, for how maybe the leaders of the world, if you like, or the governments of the world are creating this sort of toxic environment that we're being pushed into, like we're just another cog on the wheel, if that makes sense. And we're living in a collectively traumatized system. And when we look at our ancestors, they live in a traumatized society. They were part of the war generation. I feel we're sitting in the transgressions of that right now. And we've got technology moving faster than ever. So we're trying to keep up. Parents are trying to keep up. The cost of living's gone up. We've had the COVID pandemic. Like, I believe we probably, I was chatting actually to my young lad yesterday, and he said, I said, you get more than we did. And he said, well, you've got more money than we did. And I said, I don't really think we've got much more money than you than we did. I don't think we've got much more money than what we had when we were kids. I said, but you get a little bit more than what maybe we got. But at the same time, there's like a big, there's a big void, if you like, in terms of how most family dynamics show up to him. Like, when we look at how I take my kids everywhere. When we were kids, when we were younger, we were on the streets. My mum and dad, we didn't have all this football, all these different activities going on. But now, no one wants the child to leave the street because of the dangers of your child leaving the street. So what we do is we say, okay, well, I'll keep your child in then, and I'll take them everywhere because I can protect them. So that's treating the effects of maybe a society, if you like, in Liverpool, where it is quite, it can be dangerous of a night time, or there is a lot of a gang culture with young men. But no one sort of addressing the issue as to why we've got a gang culture within young men. But when you look deeply, you know, men that come in my room, Tim, and sit in the space with me and do the courses with me, I would say there's 95% plus of them men have had an issue with their father, whether he was absent, whether he was there but emotionally unavailable, whether he was violent, whether there was domestic violence, whether he was an addict, whether he had his own problems going on. There is a massive, massive issue with how men are bringing men into society, because for as much as I love my mum and how amazing the women are of this city and of the world, they cannot replace the dynamic of what it means to have a strong masculine role model in your life. And that's why I love the importance of boxing gyms, if you like, because that's a place where you will get some sort of healthy male connection. But I believe, you know, again, we could go really deep on this, Tim, but there's certainly an issue going on right now in the world with men. And it comes down for me to a lack of men knowing how to actually show up, knowing how to be men, knowing what it actually means to be a man. I mean, going to work and just paying the bills isn't enough for a woman anymore. They can do that themselves. They don't need us no more in that way. You know, some of them are fighting, they're playing football, if you like. You know, they're just as equal, which, you know, for me, they always should have been as equal. But at the same time, it's frowned upon, Tim, for women to stay at home and look after the kids and raise the kids. That's frowned upon, that they raise the kids or look after the man in that way, which is equally as important, if you like, to the family dynamic. When you look at travel times, the man would go out and he would go and conquer, he would go and provide the food. He would actually sleep on the outside. There'd be a circle around the tribe, around the outside, with the women and children would be inside, because men would be the protector. Now, when we look at what's going on in the world, we've got women who are becoming hyper-masculine, if you like. So we're living in a depolarized world where it's okay for, you know, women, we've all got masculine and feminine within us, Tim. But to have a balance of masculine and feminine, we don't need more masculine women. We need more feminine women coming into the world of hyper-masculine men to then create some sort of power dynamic that we bounce off each other. You look at the world of work and the world of schools and, you know, the world we live in, it's more about money and cost than lives, people and love. Well, you look at the qualities of a feminine woman, a centered feminine woman. It's a woman who's loving, a woman who's knitting, a woman who's playful, a woman who's childlike. These things are missing. We're not even allowed to give. And by the way, I'm not saying we should be allowed to hug every kid, but this came up on a course we were on with the I Am Project. the child comes up to you to give you a hug. We're not allowed to do that. Is that not natural for the child who has a relationship with you in school? Should they not be allowed, if they're crying, to be supported by you emotionally with touch? Like, we're not allowed to touch anybody anymore. You know, we're driving separation between people, and separation is a key principle of a traumatized environment. So for me, we need, you know, this sort of, certainly in the schooling dynamics, I do understand for safeguarding reason why these type of things are in place, by the way. I'm not someone who's going to say, you know, we don't need them things in place, but surely there has to be a level of common sense where we're not red taping around human interaction and actually human connection and human touch and actually human care and love. It seems like it's you know, is that more much bureaucracy, if you like, that common sense has gone out the window. So that's something that for me, if you like, is a big issue with not just what we're seeing in children, but what we're actually seeing in the world, in our families, in our homes, in our, even I noticed the issues that can show up in my own house in terms of how technology can be so engaging that you could have 3 years sitting in the same room, but no one's talking to one another. Now that's happening on a collective level. We're going to work and we're not talking to one another. We're always on our devices. We've got kids who can't interact with one another anymore. Communication skills are going down. I thought intelligence levels were meant to go up, but it seems like because of how fast technologies may be moving, things seem to be taking a step backwards.
That's tremendous stuff. And you speak really well at an analytical level. You know, it's not just a case of you raise some good points, but you link it all together as well, which I think is really, really powerful. But I couldn't agree more. And one of the big things I find is that you often hear about people in education saying, oh, kids are going to secondary school and not making as much progress as they were in primary school. And for years, they've been going on about this. And I'm thinking, well, what do you expect? They're in one room with one person where they know everyone and they're kind of familiar with people. And then all of a sudden, they're walking around this huge building with these big year 11 kids pushing and barging them. And every lesson, they're going to different lessons, different seats, different dynamics, sometimes a lesson they don't like. And we're expecting them to be okay. You know, it really does beg a belief. It really does beg a belief.
When are we going to step away, Tim, from just focusing on the intellect?
Mm-hmm.
When are we going to step away from actually just focusing on making kids more clever and more intelligent and actually say this kid needs to be emotionally secure, needs to be emotionally intelligent, he needs to actually know what his purpose is in life, he needs to know self-development, he needs to know what it means to be happy.
Mm.
Where does that get lost? My lad has just gone to high school, and already, you know, I've seen this with my older lad. Very quickly, you knock the life out of them. You lose the childhood spirit. You go into year 7, believing in Father Christmas. You come out of year 11, hating school and hating life. That surely, they're in school more than they're with their parents. So something fundamentally, Tim, is going wrong within the school system, because they're more interested in results than the lives of these kids being happy. And they're on pressure from Ofsted. So this systematic problem, again, that it's results-driven, that is results over lives and results over health, is absolutely crazy that we're not giving these kids from, I would say, the age of 2, 3, 4, when they go into nursery, that we're not teaching them the art of self-regulation, co-regulation, loving one another, helping one another, gratitude, meditation, little breathing practices, asking the people okay, learning what empathy is, learning that it's not all about maybe results. Results, yeah, are important. But just as important for me is that we look after the mental and emotional wellness of kids. That, for me, is actually more important than a results-driven business.
Do you know, there was a student a few years ago when a mum came in on parents' evening, and she said, how's she doing? I said, do you know what? I said, she's the happiest student I've ever taught. You know, she's always smiling. And like I said, I'm so, like, envious of her. Probably says more about me than it does about her, but I said she's always happy, nothing seems to bother her. I said she's got such a great approach to life, and her mum said, oh yes, she is like that. I said, whatever you've done there or whatever's gone on, you know, that she'll take that right through her life. It was just really nice to observe that. But I mean, I remember a counsellor once, I went for counselling a few years ago, I remember the counsellor just said to me in the third session, went, stop it, Stop with the intellect and trying to rationalise everything. Just tell me how you feel. It was like a bit of a breakthrough moment, you know, where I thought, ooh, she's really onto something here. And then I said, she said, why did you do, tell me about those things in your life. Why did you do it? Tell me why. What were you feeling at the time? It was like a real breakthrough. And sometimes, like, you need these little breakthroughs. Like, when I was 29, and I think your story as well, sometimes you need to go through those bad times to come out the other side and go, ooh, I didn't quite realise there what I was doing wrong, etc. But I think it's a whole minefield, isn't it? The whole well-being thing and education.
Just a quick one, mate. What I'd say is, just a funny thing to say, is go and ask your kids to play adults. That'll tell you everything you're doing to your child. Go and ask them, what do adults do? And he'll go, sit down, shut up, do your job. All serious. Where does that seriousness come from? And then we lose being actually childlike and having fun with life. And that's a big issue. That's part of the problem. Go and ask them what they see.
It's good that, isn't it? I mean, I always think, like, you know, people say, oh, God, the things kids say, the thing kids do to each other, the terrible, aren't they? You know, when they start getting into the little groups and being unkind to each other. And I always think, like, well, that might be true, but I don't see them, like, putting each other in gas chambers and bombing people from, like, a great height or whatever. But it is interesting, isn't it, how we learn, how those, being an adult is learned behaviour, and how we're all culpable and how that presents itself. Tell us about the I Am Project then, because you do a lot of work in schools. You've got Pack Mentality, which is its own organisation, but you've also got a CIC, a community interest company. You do a lot of work in schools running programmes. What does that seek to do, the I Am Project?
So the I Am Project is basically about creating foundations within the school system that allows us to implement some of the things we just spoke about, if you like, in terms of teaching these kids about different dimensions within them other than intellect. So we're teaching them about mental wellness. We're teaching them how to be mentally well. We're teaching them about emotional regulation, self-regulation, how to be empathetic. We're teaching them how to regulate their anger, that it's okay to have anger. We're talking to them about the home life, what's going on, is everything okay? We're giving them a space and a sharing circle to voice anything that might be coming up for them in their lives. We also, you know, we're doing boxing with them or, you know, mixed martial arts. So Scano will go in and maybe do the UFC with them and the MMA stuff with them. So we're getting the physical element, getting rid of a lot of that pent-up energy that some of them have had. You know, we're getting kids coming in who are struggling majorly maybe with the intellectual side of school and behavioural problems because they've got ADHD or they've got these, you know, other labels that they're getting given. If you like, because they're not conforming. So they're coming to us and we're doing some work with them, obviously giving them tools I've just mentioned to you. And then they're going back and we're seeing massive improvements in how they actually show up, not just in the classroom, but as young people. We're helping them with goal setting. We're helping them with healthy habits. We're teaching them about, you know, how to have a purpose in life. Maybe to start thinking about that now for what you want to do, you know, when you're 12, 13. Maybe what you want to do when you're 16, 17, 18. What would happen if you started taking steps towards that now? We've actually had a couple of massive, massive successes in some of the schools with some of the kids actually setting up their own businesses at 12, 13, selling clothes, you know, having their own brands made, and they start to step into entrepreneurship at such a young age. They've got these little online businesses. They may be doing this with the parents, by the way, which we always advise them to do it, but if they want to learn about the stock market for when they're older, maybe start learning now about how to do them type of things in crypto. And if you want to be a millionaire, I say to them, why are you looking at the kid next to you on the street? Or why are you looking at the divvy on the street who might be driving around as a drug dealer with all the clothes, the girls, the cars? I said, but how long do you think that's going to last and how sustainable is it? If I want to be a millionaire, then I better be looking at what it takes to be a millionaire. You're within the age of information, which means that to become a millionaire, you've got access to the best people in the world right now at your fingertips. So instead of maybe sitting on your phone, watching 30-minute videos, laughing all night and maybe not getting engaged properly, or sitting on your game playing Call of Duty or Fortnite or FIFA, what about if you started reading books or watching videos on YouTube of some of these leading people in the field of making money and you start to digest that information now? Imagine what will happen when you're 16. as well as you're doing breathing practices, meditation, like you're doing some cold water therapy. You know, you might be reading books, you might be watching motivational videos. We're giving them access to some of these sort of resources that have helped us. So every one of the mentors, if you like, on the I Am Project are all heavily invested in their self-development. So we're giving them all the tools and practices that have worked for us. You know, we're not expecting to turn around within 6 to 12 weeks and see kids, you know, massively down the line where we're at. That's not the point. But what we're trying to do is plant the seed right now and give them information that without us being there, they would never have maybe invested in, took the time to learn or being interested in. So we're doing it in a way that we buy them in through the maybe the boxing and combat side of things. And then we filter in the information through other avenues, if you like. And then each week we'll check in with them to see how they're getting on. Have they implemented some of these things? If they haven't, why haven't they implemented it? And basically they all come to, or the last class I had, if you like, Kane, I said, why are you here? And he said, because we're naughty. And I said, if you're naughty and that's why you think you're here, I said, you've just been given the best prize that you will ever get by getting to spend time in this room with us, with a bunch of lads, having a laugh, doing the things you're going to learn. You will learn more here than you'll ever learn in all of your life about your own self-development. So actually, you've just won the lottery, mate. Mm-hmm. And they all laugh and they're all made up. And, you know, by the end of week 12, by the way, you know, they're all your best mates. They all sang to me when I was leaving the room before Christmas. And you've got 10, 11, 12-year-old lads all singing to you, 13-year-old, maybe, whatever they are. But they're all, like, buzzing to see you. They're all wanting to give you a hug. They're all giving you punches when you're going. And it's amazing to see that we're having that impact on people. But essentially, if we're only getting that 12 weeks, how long are we going to be able to sustain change? For me, we should be absolutely part of the curriculum. The teachers haven't really got the capacity nor the skill set to be able to do and deliver it in a way that we deliver it. I'm not coming in as a teacher, which I get very clear to the kids in there. I was you one day. I'm a lad from the street. I tell them my story. I tell them my struggles. I tell them my problems. I tell them I've worked in places of work. Tell them I've been involved in the crazy environments when I was younger, if you like, and the bad situations I put myself in. I'm very, very open and transparent with the kids. So as soon as they know you're not coming in to be a teacher, to order them around, to tell them what to do, there's a level of respect that's created within the room, if you like, that you're sort of one of them, that you're not coming in to take anything from them or to give them anything. You're just coming in to support them and help them. And I find that for me personally works really, really well. So with the success of the programme, I know that we ran it for a couple of years in the schools with Scanon and Jimmy, that I think they've tapped into a lot of funding from the Merseyside Violence Reduction Programme. That we're now in, I think there's about 12 schools, 12 to 15 schools in Merseyside that we're in, and we're working with year groups on 12-week programmes, if you like. So when I go back, I'm on another 12-week programme with the year sevens, and I know Carly's the same. So for me, it's all about, I could go and do something for meeting with that time that's maybe more financially rewarding to me. And at the same time, it's really important to me that I'm able to commit and make the difference, even if it's just the one child out of the 12 to 15 that are in the room. It's so important to me that I'm taking this work and I'm actually a leading figure in making sure that we're creating change for the young men of this city. So regardless, I mean, a lot of people work on the I Am Project also, Tim, for free. There's people that are turning up to the sessions and they're not taking a penny. They're going and then they're putting the money back into the I Am Project to make sure that we can keep this and make this sustainable in the city. And I hope that it's the start of not just this happening in Liverpool, but actually happening further across the board and around the country.
Brilliant. And I've had a look at the I Am Project, and I'm doing some work with Jimmy in one of those schools and looking to support the I Am Project myself, which is phenomenal. And it's great, isn't it, the way you look at choice theory and things like that and try to empower people as much as possible and the holistic development of people. I think it's so important. So that's one aspect of what you do. You've also got the Pack Mentality organisation itself, and we'll put all the details in the notes. I'm really inspired from today. I'm going to go and write some stuff down after this, which I found really, really helpful too. But moving forward, I know we spoke about the transition from choosing something like pack mentality and then making it financially sustainable, which can be difficult. And you said you had the project management you were doing, which you were doing while you were getting it set up. But what advice would you give to people? It doesn't have to be about setting up an organisation like pack mentality, but just in terms of changing their life around, really, just to finish with. Any observations or thoughts?
Yeah, I think in terms of if you're stepping into a new career or your purpose or you're trying to find what it is you want, I would say my best bit of advice I give to people is, what would you do for free and monetize it? Mm-hmm. So what do I love to do that I could do for free that I can monetize? I sit in a room with 10 to 15 men, sometimes the kids when I'm in the schools, and I sit there and think, I'm getting paid to talk about what I love. I'm getting paid to do this work. I would sit there and help. I would sit in the schools for free. I would turn up to a men's group once a week and talk for free. And I get to do this because I've monetized it to make myself that good at what I do that it actually just flows through me because I'm aligned. I'm not having to force myself to do the job I'm doing because I'm actually, it's sort of, I'm in a flow state when I'm doing it. So I don't worry about how I am when I turn up. I don't worry about being authentic. I show up completely as I am, with my own problems, the stuff that goes on in my own life. And I share that with people and I give them all the tools and information that have helped and supported me. So if anyone is trying to find their purpose or trying to step into something they want, I would sit with that. And I would even, I think, you know, when you look at some of the great teachers and great entrepreneurs and great creators in the world, whether that's in music or anything else, you know, art, they've sat down sometimes in a dark room and closed their eyes. And he've asked himself the question, what is my purpose? How do I get to where I want to go? What do I want to do? And when we start to ask the question, we start to find the answers. But if we always just continue to do what we've always done, we'll always get what we've always got. So it's about sort of asking the right questions of yourself and maybe just allowing yourself to settle down, allowing your breathing to settle down, your brainwave frequencies to settle down. And then the answers will come through for what it is you actually want to do. Now, giving anybody any advice, if you like, in terms of how to be maybe help the mental health, how to help the mental wellness, how to become more emotionally resilient. If you like, you know, the first and foremost go-to thing for me and practice is breathing. Because your breathing is a direct biohack to your nervous system, your heart rate variability, and your brainwave frequencies. So when you're angry, you breathe a certain way. When you're happy, you breathe a certain way. When you're excited, you breathe a certain way. So when you become aware that you're anxious, you guess what? You're going to be breathing a certain way. When you alter your breathing to a certain pattern, that will change you'll completely change your whole physiology for how you show up in that moment. Now, it might take 20 minutes. It might take half an hour. It might take an hour to get back to a point where you feel better. But essentially, if it takes 1 hour, otherwise you would have lost 8 hours of being angry. What's the cost? I would sooner sit there for 30 minutes, an hour, getting myself back into a state that I am actually enjoying my life at, and I'm actually, you know, in a flow state, than spend the next 8 hours being angry. So I would say consider bringing a breathing practice into your life. And we think that this is, you know, the reason why this isn't being sold by the NHS and pharmaceutical industries, Tim, because there's no money in breathwork. There's no money in telling someone how to breathe because they get to do it themselves. But really, doing it yourself and being empowered yourself is what you may be not being told and stuff that we should be getting told.
Absolutely. And I think that's a great way to finish it there. Find what you love and then look at how you can do it sustainably and look at the basics, such as the way that you breathe, the way you meditate, the way you talk to yourself. I think that the way people talk to themselves sometimes, that's a big part of my kind of positive thinking each day. But the breathing stuff, I remember like when the whole Wim Hof thing kind of kicked off a few years ago, there's a lot of people going, oh, it can't be that easy to breathe. But by controlling your breathing and to mindfully breathe, it might just be noticing that you're breathing. You just connect with yourself and you stop that chatter mind and then you can reflect. And I think what you just said there, like if you've got something on your mind or you're thinking about something, think about it, state it, get calm and then let the answers kind of come to you, as it were. It's all part of that self-reflection that's so important. Mm-hmm. But yeah. Paul, that's brilliant. And this has been a fantastic podcast in its own right, just hearing you talk. I've learned so much from you and the way you summarise things. We'll put Pack Mentality's details in the notes. The I Am Project, good luck with that as it expands more and more. I think it's very, very important work. And I think the way you've been through things and turned it around and turned it into something positive that you feel that you want to do, I just think it's an inspiration to all of the people out there who are just feeling, this isn't right what I'm doing now. And, you know, you can take the next step, can't you? So I think that's an important way to finish. But thanks for coming on and thanks for giving up your time, and best of luck for the future.
Thank you for asking me on, Tim.
No worries, been a pleasure, Paul.
Thank you, mate.